Hi, this is Janie Reasoner, and welcome to Women's Voices. My guest this evening is Starhawk. I'm very grateful she is able to be with us. Before I introduce her, I'd like to share a few thoughts. I just caught Helen Caldicott's last words this morning from a passionate talk she had given in Albuquerque, New Mexico in March, entitled, From Hiroshima to Fukushima. In her final words, she pointed out our dreadful coal corporations and oil and nuclear corporations and our constant warring, all driven by corporate power and lust for money, which is poisoning our earths and the oceans. All of that comes from this country. We, the most powerful country, destroying the world. Thus, we who live here have the obligation and the opportunity to bring it to a halt. For the sake of the world. She ended with this cry, You have no right to do nothing. Her remark was met by thunderous applause. And here comes Starhawk's powerful movie, which has its own message to tell, with its own power to affect us on many, many levels. Women are stepping forth in all areas of life, describing other ways of being, telling us a different story from the ones we've been fed and propagandized by. I believe an unseen but powerful force, the re-emergence of the sacred feminine, is calling us, pushing us, driving us to take this patriarchal world and shake it into consciousness, to wake us up. Thank you. Starhawk is one of the most respected voices in the revival of earth-based spirituality and goddess religion. She is also well known as a global justice activist and organizer and permaculture teacher, whose work and writings have inspired many to action. She is a panelist for the Newsweek Washington Post website on religion, on faith, and also contributes to BeliefNet and ZNet, as well as maintaining her own blog, Dirt Worship, www.starhawksblog.org. She holds a BA in Fine Arts from UCLA. In 1973, as a graduate student in film at UCLA, Starhawk won the prestigious Samuel Golden Creative Writing Award. She received an MA in psychology with a concentration in feminist therapy from Antioch University West in 1982. She has taught in several Bay Area colleges and universities, including John F. Kennedy University, Antioch West, the Institute of Culture and Creation Spirituality at Holy Names College, and Wisdom University. She is presently adjunct faculty at the California Institute of Integral Studies. In the late 80s, she consulted on and co-wrote the popular trio of film known as the Women's Spirituality Series, directed by Donna Reed, for the National Film Board of Canada, Goddess Remembered, The Burning Times, and Full Circle. She is the author or co-author of 12 books, including The Spiral Dance, A Rebirth of the Ancient Religion of the Great Goddess, long considered the essential text for the neo-pagan movement, and the now classic Ectopian novel, The Fifth Sacred Thing. Her new exciting project is to create a movie set in San Francisco from The Fifth Sacred Thing. She writes, "We need strong voices now to raise up a powerful countercry, to say that all of us have value, that we are here on earth to take care of one another, to proclaim that every difference of background and culture and perspective is a gift. We need a vision of how we might live in such a world, for if we can't imagine it, how can we create it?" And, "Consciousness is the most stubborn stuff in the universe and the most fluid," says Lily, a character in the novel, The Fifth Sacred Thing. "It can be rigid as concrete and it can change in an instant. A song can change it, or a story, or a fragrance wafted by on the wind." Welcome to Women's Voices, Starhawk.
Hi, great to be on.
Thank you. It's wonderful to have you here. And you're leaving tomorrow for England?
So Germany tomorrow, and then Switzerland, and then England.
Wow.
And then Poland.
Oh, my gosh.
And then I'm going to Jordan for the International Permaculture Convergence.
Wow.
I'll be there in mid-September.
How wonderful. How exciting. And what a lot to do. The first question I ask my guests is how did your own mother influence you to become the woman that you are today? What part did she play in all of that?
Well, you know, my mother was a second generation in an immigrant Jewish family, and she had to fight pretty hard for some of the things she wanted in her life, to get an education in particular. She always tells the story that her parents took her out of college when she was 19, so they could send her younger brother to yeshiva, to a rabbinical school in Chicago when he was 13.
Wow.
And she never really, you know, forgave them for it. She went and became a secretary, and that was during World War II, and moved to Washington, D.C. during the war years, and worked actually, I think, in Alger Hiss's office. The government. And then she said when she was 29, she was very depressed, and she went to see a therapist, and she had 5 sessions, and in the 5th session she said, "What am I doing here with you? I'm going back to Minnesota and going back to college." And that's what she did. She grew up in Minnesota. Her family was from there, and Minnesota had free, accessible public education. So she became a social worker and a psychotherapist. And I think one of the ways she influenced me, you know, she was very passionate about her work. And so she was a great model of a woman who was doing work that she loved and work that she felt made a difference and that really helped make other people's lives better. She also became an expert in loss and grief. My father died when I was 5 and my little brother was only 9 months old, so she was left as a single mom to raise us. And she sort of took her own grief and really turned it into her field. And I think I learned a lot from her about grief as a process and about, you know, facing some of those more painful areas of life and not running away from them, not dodging them, not trying to avoid them, but that really if you embrace them and allow yourselves to go through them, you come out the other side and it can be a deepening, a healing, and a transforming experience.
Yes, yes. Wow, what a lady.
Yeah.
Well, that's wonderful. That's just amazing. And I can see what a model she has been for you.
Yeah.
Because you are so powerful. You know, you're amazing. You dare to get right out in the middle of things. And I've wondered, where does your strength and your daring come from? But I see. But it also comes, I would assume, from experience, one experience building on the next.
You know, I think we have a chant that we sing in Reclaiming, which is my kind of extended spiritual network organization that goes, where there's fear, there's power. And again, understanding fear, all of those things, that rather than letting that be a reason to stop, often it's telling you, actually, this is a reason to go forward if, you know, if you are on a path of self-development. Not all, you know, some kinds of fear are definitely like, don't do that, right?
Sure,
not safe,
sure.
But the other kinds, not so much the don't step over that cliff kind of fear, but that, oh, you know, kind of, you know, that little kind of nervous rush you get when you're about to start something new, or you fear you might fail at something, or you haven't done something before.
Right.
Often that's a sign that if you go forward, you may learn something new.
Yeah.
And you might succeed or you might fail, but at least you will have experienced some whole other dimension.
That's true. Absolutely. Uh-huh. Could you talk a little more about your own development from childhood and to the young woman that you were out in the world? What other things have played a part in your becoming who you are?
Well, you know, of course, I grew up just at the age where I was 16, 17 years old in the height of the 60s. And you know, was in college right in the middle of all that ferment and, you know, kind of came of age at that time. So that, of course, was a huge influence in me. Had it not been for all of that social revolt and experimentation and all those things that people were doing, I probably would have lived a much duller life.
And how did the goddess come into your world?
When I was in freshman at UCLA in 1968, my friend Patty and I took an anthropology course and decided to do a project together on witches. We had no idea really what we were doing, but we started researching and studying and getting together and talking, and we eventually met some people who called themselves witches and came and started to talk to us about the goddess. And for me, it was just a revelation. I had never really thought about the idea of seeing the divine, seeing the sacred in female form. It was tremendously empowering.
I bet.
And so I began reading and learning. They had us reading Robert Graves' The White Goddess, which I have to say is like a really difficult book to slog through when you're 17, right, and don't have a classical education. But it was, again, it was very illuminating, the whole idea that underlying Christianity, Judaism, all of these religions and traditions, there is this much older tradition that really has to do with worship of nature, worship of the earth, honoring the female body, honoring sexuality, honoring the male body, because it's really honoring life on this earth as the terrain of the sacred.
Yeah. Beautiful. Well, you know, and then there's permaculture and all of that, too, which I don't know when that came into. Of course, that's part of being connected to the earth and protecting it and nourishing it and helping it continue.
Well, you could say permaculture, in some sense, is, to me, is the practical application of the understanding that the earth is sacred. It's the how-to part.
Mm-hmm. And people all over the world are becoming more and more hungry for how to do that, aren't they?
Well, I think we know that we are so out of balance as a society that in order to survive, we really need to find a way to come back into relationship with the earth in many, many different ways, including the way we generate our energy, the way we grow our food, the way we live on this planet. Mm-hmm. And we don't have a lot of time left to do that if we want to avoid just major catastrophes. Yeah. We're already seeing major catastrophes.
Yes, we are.
So I think that people are hungry for the knowledge and also to try to figure out how we marshal the political will to actually do it.
Mm-hmm. Which is a hard one.
Yeah. The knowledge isn't the hard one.
No.
The knowledge we have, but it's the political will. That's the hard one.
Also, I think we don't quite know what to do. You know, we don't know what tack to take. It's like the path.
Oh, we know what to do. We just don't want to do it.
What would? How do we bring what those guys are doing to a halt? And
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, we know what we need to do to turn the situation around. You know, that's not difficult. No-brainer, really.
Right. But do you think, I mean, I think about, should we all go to the streets? I mean, what is this mass thing that's going to really, you know, enable a great change?
Yeah, I mean, that I wish I knew. At some point, I'd say, yeah, we go to the streets, but going to the streets is only one part of it. Much as I've spent plenty of time in the streets, right.
Yes, you have.
Getting people out in the streets. You know, I mean, the streets are, there's really probably no change, major change takes place without going to the streets. But when you've gone to the streets, you also kind of have to know, so then what are we going to the streets for? Not just what are we going against, but what do we want to create? What do we want to see? How is it going to work? How can we imagine living and really working and producing what we need in a way that's very different from the way that we do it today. And I think for me that's why I've been putting so much time and energy into actually making a movie out of The Fifth Sacred Thing, because I feel like we need to have some vision of the future that's positive here on Earth. If we can't imagine it, we're not going to be able to create it. And we don't have a lot of positive visions out there. We have some, you know, in books, but I can't honestly think of a single movie or film that shows a really positive vision of Earth. And the truth is that a lot of people don't read books anymore. People are visually oriented, you know, it's what they watch, it's what they listen to. They aren't going to sit down and read a whole book about something, unfortunately, I think. But, right.
That's true, and that's why The Fifth Sacred
Especially
Thing
younger people.
Is so important to do it in a movie. That's so exciting. Mm-hmm. I'm just thrilled about that happening, and I want to interrupt and say, You're listening to Women's Voices on KZYX. I'm Janie Reisner. I'm here with my guest, Starhawk, and we are talking about her book, The Fifth Sacred Thing, being made into a movie, which is totally exciting. You've been getting funds from initially from Kickstarter.
Yes. Kickstarter is a website where you can put up your creative project and then people can donate. And the way it works is if you set a funding goal and if you reach it, you get the money. If you don't reach it, you don't get anything and no one gets charged anything. So we're down to the last 2 weeks of our Kickstarter campaign now, and we've been very fortunate. We've had such a tremendous response that we met our initial goal, but our initial goal, I think we set kind of low because we wanted to be sure we would make it.
Sure.
So now we're really trying to push in this next couple weeks to get what our original goal was, which would have been $100,000, which is actually closer to what we really need to get to the next stage of this process.
Right.
People know making a movie is staggeringly expensive, and so it's going to need major investment of some kind and a financial. The financial complexities are luckily not something I'm going to try to work out.
Good. There's somebody else. Good.
Well, that's what the money, you know, the money will go to getting, as they say, and the guy who makes the waterfall happen. It's a wonderful way people talk in Hollywood. That strange mixture of natural metaphors and hotel metaphors where if people are coming in on the mezzanine and, I don't know, I sit in the meetings and I'm off on, you know, well, what about the people who want to come in the cloud forest? How about the underground tunnels? But basically, we need to get the people who are really, really smart at that sort of thing and the lawyers who are really, really sharp at that sort of thing to put it all together. And fortunately, we've done so much work on it already. We already have a screenplay. We have a lot of art, a lot of concepts, and an incredible collection of people who want to be involved, amazing creative people, community organizations that we want to partner with. I wrote up a green plan for the project so that, you know, I thought, gosh, if we're going to do something that's involving this much money, how can I justify it, right? We're going to have to use that for good, not just, you know, we're going to have to make this set a new bar for ecologically sensitive production and try to take these resources and channel them to people in places that need them, you know, to work with some of the organizations that we already have longstanding partnerships with, like in inner city San Francisco, to set up internships and training so we can get some of the youth and they're involved and excited about potential careers. And we want to use the sets and the gardens that we create to make the streets of San Francisco in the future come alive, and do it in a way where we can leave them as a legacy for the city and not just have to tear everything down when we're done and throw it away like most movies do.
Right. And it's so exciting to hear you talk about it. It's just thrilling. And especially to have it happen in San Francisco, which is so close and we're familiar with it. And I can just see all the streets torn up and filled with gardens, just like from the book.
Well, there may be listeners there who aren't familiar with the book, but I'll just say that, you know, it's set in mid-21st century San Francisco, which has become, after, you know, social breakdown and ecological catastrophe, it has become a place that's really in harmony with nature and where diversity is celebrated and where art and culture and music and pleasure are celebrated. But then it gets invaded by the Southlands, which have gone real in completely the opposite direction, much more militarized and divided in terms of race and class and everything else. And so it really centers around the question of what do you do? How does a peaceful society defend itself against violence without becoming what it's fighting against? And one of the main characters is Maya, who's the witch and the storyteller and the old wise woman, and then Madrone, who is the healer and the midwife, and then there's Bird, who is the musician who's become a guerrilla fighter, has been down the Southlands, been captured and imprisoned and wounded very badly, but escapes to warn the city and then to wrestle with these questions of what do you do? How do you fight?
I've read the book several times, and I've just finished reading it again, and kind of because we were going to have this conversation, but the characters have taken, they seem so real to me. They just so strongly real. I love all the interior dialogue. And and you know, I thought something that was very interesting, that this was written in 1993, and talking about putting chips in people to keep track of them, which, of course, is just around the corner for most of us, I think. You know, they're certainly wanting to do that right now.
Well, we already have it. We already have one in the dog, which I have to say has been useful. when the dog got lost,
yes,
one time. But,
right.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, and I think they do, people have put them in their children for the same reason.
Yeah, I think that's horrible myself, but... And I noticed that you said that there are a lot of people who want to be part of it. And add me to that list. I can imagine you've had all kinds of people who just want to have a finger in it, you know?
Yeah, it's, you know, to me, it's very exciting to see that people have come for, you know, musicians, artists, people are very excited to get involved, and we've had also, you know, some wonderful people who have been working in film and just have really stepped forward to consult and to mentor and to offer their advice and their help. I think that there's a lot of people who are out there who are hungry to do something that has meaning and that's more than just a cool idea, but you know, an idea that might conceivably have impact.
Absolutely. One thing that very much interested me was about the bees, your connection with the goddess and the bees. And not long ago, I interviewed Marguerite Rigoglioso, if you may know her name, and she talked about the bees and the goddesses of antiquity, and the temples where bees were obviously a part of all of it. And how you used that and seem the talk, you talked about the bee consciousness, is just amazing. I mean, I just thought it was fascinating, and I loved following that myself, and I could just go along with the bees wherever they were going. I just felt so much a part of it.
Well, in the book, again, Madrone goes down to the Southlands to try to offer some of her healing skills down there, and she becomes initiated by the bee priestesses who live in harmony with the bees and, you know, have a very, almost psychedelic experience going into bee consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say that was a lot of fun to write. I spent a lot of time reading about bees, went out to my friend's beehives and meditated, learned a lot about bees, and just...
Well, you know, there's so much a part of... Right now, there's so much focus on bees, and again, learning from them, and also very concerned about their depletion and what's happening to them. And the woman who was the head of the bees, the Melissa?
Mm-hmm.
Where did that seem... That title seems so familiar. Is there a goddess of antiquity that is...
Well, Melissa is the Greek word for bee, so, that's where it came from.
Right. I think people need to know where they can go and read it. Kickstarter would be a good website to direct people to, wouldn't it, to read about your project so that they can contribute?
If you go to Kickstarter and you just search for The Fifth Sacred Thing, you can find it. You can also go to fifthsacredthing.com, and there's a link to Kickstarter. And there's a link from my website, which is starhawk.org.
And you've done lots of writing about it, but on the Kickstarter has lots of writing, which is wonderful.
Yeah, and my blog, which is starhawksblog.org, I've also done some writing about it.
Right. You talk about using the concepts of permaculture, I guess, when in making the movie.
Yes. You know, the plan, the green plan that I wrote up, sort of looked at some of the permaculture principles and how they apply to the way that we want to go about making the movie. You know, for example, one of the permaculture principles, really I say the overriding principle, is to realize that abundance is about relationships, not about things. It's not even about money or profits. It really comes from relationships. So even though the three of us who are producing this movie, myself, Philip Wood, and Paradox Pollock, none of us actually have very much money to start with. You know, we have a wealth of relationships, and through those relationships, hopefully we're able to generate all the resources that we'll need to bring it about. Mm-hmm. Another permaculture principle we call stacking functions. Every element in the system serves more than one function. So by doing the project in as ecologically sound and carbon neutral a way as we possibly can, now, first of all, it's the right thing to do. Secondly, doing that, we believe, will ultimately save money. And thirdly, it becomes becomes part of the PR, the buzz about the movie and the excitement about the movie. And from our point of view, fourthly, building that buzz and excitement about the movie in that way at this stage means that when we go to try to get money and investors, we're going to be attracting people who are hopefully in sympathy with those values or who at least understand the importance of honoring those values, because what we're trying to forestall is the thing that often happens, which is you have all the wonderful ideals and then you go get the money people in and they say, well, actually, we're not doing it that way. We're doing it this way. You know?
Right.
And we don't want that to happen. So we're using all of our skills, our strategy, and our magic to try to put out into the universe our vision and attract the forces that are going to be in alignment with the vision. And it's, for me, truly, it's definitely a magical challenge. And we'll see if it works. Right?
Yeah. For sure.
Yeah.
Well, I bet it will. How's that?
Okay. Right.
Well, I know you...
And if anybody wants to bet with a few bucks, like... You know, we are happy to take anything from a dollar on up because we're also trying to collect, you know, as many active backers as we can on Kickstarter because, again, that shows not only do we have, that gives us some of the money we need to go get all of the pieces and get them put together, but it also, so really shows and demonstrates that there is a groundswell of support for this project. And, you know, a lot of people interested, a lot of eyes on it, a lot of people already excited about it. And that is something that investors are really interested in. You know, that is worth gold in terms of trying to get people to believe in your movie and get it made.
Yes, I can imagine. I can imagine. So this is, I'm reading about, you know, to work magic, I'm going backwards, to work magic, you need a vision. And so this is what you're creating.
Yeah. You have a vision, and then you put your energy behind that vision and align yourself with that vision, and then you attract to that vision the forces that you need to make it real.
Hmm.
And that's what we're trying to do with the movie, and then the movie itself is a way trying to do that with the world. You know, put a vision out there, and that hopefully will spark a lot of people, not just to sign on to our vision, but to actually create their own vision
mm-hmm.
and mm-hmm. To be part of a whole interactive community of people who are out there already. I mean, there's so many people doing such great work trying to make the transformation happen in so many ways. So helping those people to find each other, see each other, feel connected to each other, feel each other as a powerful force in the world, and also have available the resources, the knowledge, skills, tools to make that difference.
In the movie, I mean in the book, could you talk a little bit about how they govern, how it's egalitarian, and women are certainly at the head of much of it?
In the book, it's a form of really direct democracy based on councils, open meetings that everyone can come to make decisions together. And it's really modeled on the way we've organized big mobilizations and actions
mm-hmm.
With consensus, with spokes councils. So when they have to make some crucial decisions, like how are we going to fight, everyone can show up and be part of that discussion, and they can really wrestle it out together and come up with a decision that people feel like they are, have been part of making. So it's not a top-down structure, it's a bottom-up structure. And in part of that, women, of course, have a strong, powerful voice, and old women are very respected. And their defense council that handles the Sudanese defenses is 9 old women who listen and dream.
That sounds perfect.
Yeah.
The other thing is, though, that you're doing is you're doing permaculture and teachings. For instance, what exactly are you going to be doing when you leave tomorrow?
Well, I'm going to Germany to teach a short introduction to permaculture course, and then I'm going to England to teach an earth activist training. Which is one of the major things that I do now. Earth activist trainings are 2-week-long intensives. The global permaculture community has a recognized curriculum that's a 72-hour curriculum to get your permaculture design certificate. So we teach that, but we teach it in a context with a grounding in spirit and a focus on organizing and activism. And we'll be doing another one in the U.S. in January. People can find out more about that. Again, there's links from my website, but there's also a website, earthactivisttraining.org. And I've also made a movie about permaculture with my friend Donna Reed, who did The Goddess Remembered and The Burning Times and Full Circle movie some years ago about the goddess. We made a movie called Permaculture, The Growing Edge, and you can find that. It's a 50-minute documentary that, again, shows some of the vision of what's happening and the ethics and the principles and the understanding of permaculture.
Mm.
You can find a link to that from my website, too.
Mm-hmm. Which is your name?
Starhawk.org, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I also have a new book coming out this fall, which is called The Empowerment Manual, A Guide for Collaborative Groups. Because in all of this work, you know, as I've been doing it and working with people for 30, 40 years or more, I've often felt that the real constraining factor is our ability to actually get along and work together effectively in groups. They say that of all the communities, the intentional communities that start, 90% of them fail mostly because of conflict of various sorts. Hmm. And I feel like we could get that number to a much lower failure rate and much higher success rate, not just of communities, but really all the work of change and transformation gets done in groups. And so many times people start off with high ideals and then run into problems. So the book kind of contains my collected experience and wisdom over many, many years of working together in collectives and various forms of collaboration. And I hope that it contains a lot of tools and understanding that are going to help make it a little bit easier for people.
Well, that sounds wonderful. Could you just, I realize it's a whole book, but what are some of the key things? I was just thinking of some of the groups that I'm in, that there must be ways to eliminate or get through those difficult places where people run into conflict.
I think there's some understandings about communication, how people communicate and how people leap to assumptions often, and sometimes a lot of conflict can be undone if people just back off their assumptions and go back to looking at actually what happened and asking about people's motivations instead of assuming.
Mm-hmm.
I think probably a lot of us have been in groups. I think every group I've ever been in, somebody at some point has stood up and said, you know, communication in this group stinks. Right? And I looked at it and I finally went, well, the thing is that in a hierarchy, communication is relatively simple to map. You know, it's a two-way flow. It's a tree pattern. It goes up, it goes down. You kind of know who you talk to and who talks to you. But in a collective or collaborative, it's like a web. And it's a much more complicated pattern. And there's multiple ways for any message to get from one point to another, and also multiple ways for it to get lost. There's many, many times when you think everybody knows something and you don't realize that somebody was missing from that meeting who just never got that piece of information. Or where you all decide to do something, but unless somebody actually says, all right, I'm going to make sure this happens, everybody assumes somebody else is taking care of it. So just paying more rigorous and careful attention to communication in very simple ways, just like saying at the end of the meeting, all right, who else needs to know about this decision, and who's going to tell them, and how are we going to know that's been done? That can forestall a lot of people's hurt feelings and complaining about being out of the loop and not being informed and that. Because oftentimes it's not intentional that they're left out of the loop, it's just that the loop has kind of become a snarl, right? And uh-huh. No one can untie the knot.
Uh-huh. Well, that's good to know. I mean, that's very important. So that sounds like a wonderful book. And it's coming out in November?
It's coming out, yeah. It'll be, I think it's off the press in October, and it should be out in bookstores by November. Mm. And also it will come out as an ebook. Mm-hmm. And in fact, The Fifth Sacred Thing is about to be released as an ebook. I think day after tomorrow it's supposed to be available. So.
Mm. Mm. Is it going on Kindle?
Yes. Yeah.
I suppose every book goes on Kindle these days, maybe.
Yeah, and it'll be in some other formats as well.
That's great. Another thing about The Fifth Sacred Thing that I enjoyed so much was the attention about food. I mean, it just, well, everything, the smells, the sights, all of it was so lush in the north.
Mm-hmm.
And the food, I mean, it made me hungry, you know. And it was all kind of like the food we already eat up here, you know.
Uh-huh.
And it was just lovely. That and the sex. There was an awful lot of sex, too.
There was an awful lot of sex.
It was really nice.
I was between relationships, I think, when I wrote it, and not getting enough, you know.
I see. It's probably why I'm enjoying it so much, too.
Right, yeah. And I'm really trying hard to make, like, it, you know, I was a film major at UCLA when I was in college and graduate school. And we used to joke about how people would always make these films that were romantic films for their student projects, and they'd start kissing, and then it would always dissolve to, like, waves crashing on the beach, you know, to symbolize that.
Right.
And we'd sort of count, like, oh, no, here it comes again, the waves crashing on the beach, right? And in those intimate moments, we'd be like, are you feeling the waves crashing? So I really looked hard to find some other metaphors besides the waves crashing on the beach.
Uh-huh. I'm curious.
Yeah.
How that's going to play out.
Uh-huh.
Well, it was, and also it was very free. Sex was very free.
Yes. You know, I can't say that worked for me in my actual life, but, you know, it was a lot of fun to imagine it.
Yes. Well, as I understand it, it was during the writing of the book that your partner came into your life. Is that correct?
Somewhere in there, yeah.
I read that someplace.
Yeah, right toward the end where it was online to be published, my partner and I got together.
Tell us how you live now. I know you live in a couple of places and you have lots of gardens of your own.
Well, I live in a collective house in San Francisco where I've lived for many, many years now, I guess since about 1986. And we also have some land up in Casadero, up in Northern California, where I can go and retreat and write. And so I do have numerous gardens, most of which are horribly neglected, because I spent more of my time this year working with community gardens here in San Francisco in Bayview Hunters Point, which is San Francisco's poorest neighborhood. There's a couple gardens that an organization called Hunters Point Family maintains where young people who are at-risk youth can get a stipend for working in the gardens and also get the experience of having a job, learn some skills, but also get some mentoring and some experience. And earn a little bit of money to help them and help their families. And so that, I was just looking at my poor garden here going, well, it definitely needs a lot of work, and it's definitely not going to get it for another couple of months. But it's been very satisfying to work with those gardens and those kids.
Oh, I can imagine. It's such a worthy project that brings a lot into their lives. And you've lived with your collective in San Francisco for many years. Have most of you been there together?
We've had people come and people go, but there's four of us now who have lived there since the early 90s, really since the beginning, and then a fifth adult who's now bought into the house.
That must be quite wonderful. I mean, obviously you just feel like family, I would assume.
And then we have a teenager and a baby in the house.
You do? How fun.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
And is there any elderly people there?
Yeah, we're all pretty elderly. We're getting more elderly by the moment.
I don't know how you do what you do. You do just a lot, and you keep on going. And, I mean, just traveling to Europe has to involve a lot of energy and moving around.
Yeah.
And tell me what... Oh, and then you're going to the conference at the end of your time in Europe.
Yes.
Could you talk about that a little bit?
Every 2 years, the International Permaculture Community puts on a big convergence where people can come and really kind of train each other, teach each other, share the work that they're doing. And this is the first time I've been able to go to one. and it's in Jordan, and it's got a special focus on water issues and dry land. So I'm very excited to go, and there's some amazing people who do incredible projects who will be presenting. So very much looking forward to that.
What do you see as your next steps regarding the movie? What's going to happen next?
The next step will be, again, to get the financial investment package together and to take the screenplay and get a little bit more artwork done, a few more pieces of concept art, and then go and look and try and find a director, because the director will also be a big factor in people's willingness to invest money in it. And the director is the one who really shapes a lot of the look and the vision and has a huge impact on the movie. So that's where we'll be going next. While I'm in Europe, my buddies will be out there looking for the directors that we want and approaching them and hoping to get them to sign on.
Oh, that would be... Do you have people in mind? Do you know who you want?
We have a list of people in mind, yeah.
So that must have been a lot of work and research to look at people and see what they've
done.
Oh,
it's terrible. We have to watch movies and more movies and more movies.
It must be fun, too.
Right.
Will it be a woman?
I don't know if it will be a woman, because to get it financed, and because it's a big movie that would involve a lot of special effects, and especially because the three of us as producers don't have a big track record doing that, we need to get a director who does. And there really are few, if any, women who have done that kind of movie. So we're looking, but...
And then there'll be actors, or will the director have more control over that than you? Or
well, the director will certainly have a big say in who we look for as far as the cast goes. But yeah, then the next step will be to get some of the major actors. And we do have Olympia Dukakis has given us a letter of interest in playing Maya.
Wow.
Yeah, and she is my top personal choice for that character.
You know, I thought of her myself. Yes.
Yeah. I just feel like she has just the right energy. And also, she's a wonderful, wonderful actress. And she's a personal friend. I know her, and she's been involved in goddess stuff herself for many years.
Right. So. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. My gosh, it looks like our time is coming to an end. Starhawk, I thank you so much. I wish you the very best in this and in everything that you're doing. May it continue to blossom. And we'll be looking for all kinds of things happening.
Well, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.